looking at, studying last time?
The Bible.
John.
Yeah. Does anybody remember the reason that John states for writing his gospel? If you look in the 20th chapter, verses 30 and 31, I'm going to repeat it all the time because... Many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these have been written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. I'm going to assume that everyone here already believes, so then why do we keep repeating it? Let's pray. Father, thank you again for your word. Lord, we thank you for service today. We thank you, Lord, for your spirit that is in us. Father, open our eyes, give us understanding. Help us, Lord, that we might grow in our faith and trust in you. Amen. So then why do we? If I assume that all of us are believers in here, then why, if John wrote that, why, if somebody asked you that, or if you asked me that, what would I reply? Why do we keep studying it if John's purpose for writing it was that we might believe that Jesus is the Christ and that by believing we'd have life? Is belief just a one-time thing? You have to keep on believing all the time, don't you? You have to keep on trusting the Lord in all things, all the time. So I asked myself that question. I thought, well, I think it was a book that Pear let me use one time, Brian Chappell's book about preaching. And he always said that there was a professor in the back of his class, the guy that wrote the book. And he goes, whenever I'm standing there, I'm going to be back there saying, so what? And that's always stuck in my mind. There's somebody back there always going, so what? Big deal. What about it? Anyways, I want to go back just very briefly to the very beginning where John writes, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being by him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. That's the first five verses. And he goes on to speak of the witness of John the Baptist, how John was called. And then he goes on to speak more about how Christ, in the Word, verse 14, he says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. Glory as the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness of him and cried out, saying, this was he of whom I said, he who comes after me has a higher rank than I, for he existed before me. For of his fullness we have all received, and grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth were realized through Jesus Christ. No man has seen God at any time. The only begotten God, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has explained him. I have a little note in my book that goes to Hebrews 1, chapter 3. And that basically is stating the same thing in so many words. Let me read that to you. Hebrews 1:3. Jesus is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of majesty. What John is getting at when he writes this about Jesus is that this is God's self-disclosure. If I wanted to talk to you, if I wanted to talk to you about something, if we were just having a conversation, how would I communicate to you what I was thinking, what was in my mind? With words, right? How are you supposed to know what I'm thinking if I don't look at you and tell you what I'm thinking? You can't read my mind, right? So I got to be able to... And words have meanings, don't they? Words mean something. When somebody talks... I was just thinking of it today where sometimes when little kids listen to words, when they're first learning about language, they might see like it's raining outside. And then we sing a song right afterwards, Our God Reigns. And we know that it's spelled two different ways, but it sounds exactly the same. To a little kid, they're like, I don't get it. And they think that he's, you know, it's raining out of something. Or the word two. We you spell it three different ways, and it has several shades of meaning, right? Words mean something, and a lot of times when we read the Bible, it's important that we have a dictionary. Even sometimes it's just an English dictionary, without having all the theological dictionaries. But sometimes it's good to have books that talk about the culture, the metaphors, the idioms, and things like that. Because they say things in their language that we don't have any clue. What does that mean? It's like, I think in the Hebrew culture, we talk about, I love you from the bottom of my heart. Well, they would say, I love you from the bottom of my liver. And we look, what? That just sounds weird, doesn't it, to us? But to them, it meant the exact same thing when we say, we love somebody from the bottom of our heart. And so, anyways, we got to always pay attention to words and their meanings. And Jesus is God's self-disclosure of God to us. We don't see him. We don't know what he looks like. And we're told to believe this God that exists, but yet we can't see him. We don't know. How are we supposed to know anything about him other than what he's given to us? He's given to us his words. In the book to read. So when Jesus came, he was God's self-disclosure. If you want to know what God is like, just look at Jesus. Look at all the things he did. And that's what John's getting at. And we're going to jump from here over to the fifth chapter of John, because that's where we left off. But I just wanted to touch a couple of things in God's in the self-disclosure of God to his people. Jesus was that expression of God, who God is. That's what Hebrews is getting at when it says he's the exact representation of his being. And I remember reading a long time ago about that, how when it talks about he's the exact representation, as we look at a dollar bill or any money, currency, what you're seeing is the stamp, the money, when they roll the ink on it or apply the ink to the plate, and then they stamp it onto that dollar. What you're seeing is the image of what's on that stamp. But when the Bible speaks of the image, it's not speaking so much of the image, like I'm using that analogy of the dollar being stamped in it, but it's the exact representation. It's almost as if it's saying it's the stamp itself, not just an image of something on a piece of paper, but the exact representation of God and his character. And anyways, we have here in the first part of John, in his prologue, this statement about the Word. When John spoke that Word to the people, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Without going into all the philosophy and all the stuff behind the Word and what logos meant to the Greeks and the Hebrews, it meant different things to the Hebrew mind when they heard that, the Word, this divine logos. And in the Greek mind, it was the reason behind the universe, the wisdom that gave it coherence, that gave it meaning, that gave it understanding. That was what the logos to the Greek was. It was this divine thing out there that gave not expression to, but just it made sense out of the world, out of all the things. You know, the Greeks were big into math. You know, a lot of the, I think it was Plato up above his thing, he said, had a sign that said, let none but geometers enter here. Because math and geometry is nothing but just this logical progression of thinking things through logically. And to the Greek mind, that's what they were thinking of, is this whole idea of logic was what held the universe. It made sense. The laws of gravity, the laws of motion, the laws of math, so that when you add two and two, it's always going to be two. And so that's how the Greek mind thought of it. And the Hebrew mind thought of it more as, you know, I'm not really all that sure and how to say how the Hebrews thought of logos in business. more like wisdom to the Hebrew mind. But when Jesus came, and John says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, he brought it, like, the whole thing to a higher level, to a whole new level that the people might understand. And as he began, he didn't just give a definition to the people. But he came and he began to show the people as much as anything. And that, to the Hebrew, is partly what the word logos means. It's the word in action as much as anything else. Like in Psalm 33, just follow along with me, if you will, before I don't want to lose you when I'm trying to say this to you. But in Psalm 33, verse 6, by the word of the Lord the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth all their host. And then I was listening to that in one of the commentators, and then I was reading through Psalm 29. I think this gets at it really good, too. How, to the Hebrew, and in this concept of the Logos, it's the word in action. Not just the word as revealing a thought, revealing something, but the word in action. And listen to what Psalm 29 says. It's only 11 verses, so I'll read the whole thing, but listen to this idea. Ascribe to the Lord, O sons of the mighty. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Worship the Lord in holy attire. Now listen to what it says about his voice. The voice of the Lord is upon the waters. The God of glory thunders. The Lord is over many waters. The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is majestic. The voice of the Lord breaks the cedars. Yes, the Lord breaks in pieces the cedars of Lebanon and makes Lebanon skip like a calf, and Syrian like a young wild ox. The voice of the Lord hews out flames of fire. The voice of the Lord shakes the wilderness. The Lord shakes the wilderness of Kadesh. The voice of the Lord makes the deer to calve and strips the forest bare. And in his temple, everything says, glory. The Lord sat as king at the flood. Yes, the Lord sits as king forever. The Lord will give strength to his people. The Lord will bless his people with peace. And as I read that, I thought about that song that we sing, and I really like that song, how the voice of the Lord breaks the cedars. Yes, the Lord breaks in pieces the cedars of Lebanon. What is it getting at there when it says that in this poetic form about the voice of God, that when God speaks, things happen? Years ago on television, before most of you were born, there was a commercial on TV about a financial company called E.F. Hutton. And the commercial went like this. There were some people sitting in a cafe, and there was a guy sitting with his buddy across, and they were talking, you know, about their portfolios or whatever. And he says, my broker is E.F. Hutton. And E.F. Hutton says, and then everybody in the whole thing got quiet. They, you know, just and looked over it with bated breath to see what E.F. Hutton was going to say about everything. Speaking about the importance of what his words were going to reveal to them about how should I invest my money. And so in this chapter, though, of the Psalms, what the writer is getting at, what David is getting at when he writes about God, is that when God speaks, things happen. The voice of the Lord breaks the cedars of Lebanon. The voice of the Lord thunders over many waters. The voice of the Lord shakes the wilderness. We think of these powerful manifestations of God as just being, And then he goes on to say that the voice of the Lord makes the deer to calf and strips the forest bare, the bear. And in his temple, everything says glory. So that's the idea that John is getting at in the Logos, that God, when he speaks, he doesn't just reveal his mind to us what he's thinking, but things happen. When God said, let there be light, there was light. Think of it. For all eternity, God existed by himself. And he was perfectly sufficient. He had no needs. There was no loneliness, no nothing. He was perfectly all-sufficient. Everything. He needed nothing. Yet he decided, for reasons of his own, to make this earth and everything in it. And he spoke, and he said, let there be light, and there was light. Out of nothing, God created everything that is and gave it being. God said, and it was. And John wrote this at the beginning of the gospel for a reason, not just that we would have some really cool stuff to look at Sunday schools, but so that the rest of the gospel of John has to be read in light of everything that was written in that prologue. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And how all things came into being, and in him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. So now we fast forward over to chapter 5 of John's Gospel. If you would turn there, please turn to John chapter 5. At the beginning of the chapter 5, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And there was, it talks about by the sheep gate in Jerusalem, a pool. It was called Bethesda. And it says that in there lay a multitude of sick people. They were lame, blind, lame. They were sick, blind, and lame. I always think of that as the three major political parties, the Democrats, the Republicans, and Independent. They were sick, lame, and blind. Whatever order and whoever you want to place it to, go ahead and have fun with it. They're all lame if you ask me. But anyways, I couldn't resist. But it says how that an angel of the Lord would go down and stir up the waters, and they had this superstition, or whether it was real, that God would somehow move the waters, and that they would. But there was a certain man who had been there for 38 years in his condition, and the Bible gives us this information. So when Jesus sees him, he says, "Do you want to get made well?" Hello? What? Honest to goodness, one of the commentaries that I read one time was like, he wasn't asking this to be, you know, stupid or demeaning to the guy. It was obvious, the answer. But what was he doing when he asked the guy, "Do you want to get made well?" And his answer was, "Sir, I have no one to put me in the water when the water stirred up. But somebody else gets down in front of me." So what was the guy doing? What was Jesus doing when he asked him the question? It was just like in John chapter 4, when he asked the woman, "Give me a drink." And they get into this long discussion. He begins, just from the one word, "Give me a drink." He asks her for a drink. And they have this discussion. Just as that woman came to draw the water out of the well, Jesus was doing something at the same time, drawing water out of another well. Not so much the well of his, that's inexhaustible supply of goodness, but that woman was like a well when he was drawing her out. When he asked her, "Go call your husband," she said, I have no husband. And Jesus said, "You're right, you have no husband, because the one that you live with now," Jesus knew her sin, her life, was all around the men that she had had. And he was drawing her out, just like he would draw some water out of that well. He drew her out, drew a confession. Think about what she said when she ran into town. She dropped her water pitcher that she had come to draw water for her needs, and she runs into town so excited, she goes, "Quick, come, listen. Come see a man who told me everything I ever did." It always cracks me up when I read that, because Jesus didn't tell her everything she ever did, but in her mind, when she confessed her sins to Jesus, because that's what she was doing, confessing her wants, her desire, her sinfulness to Jesus, Jesus was drawing her out, just like she came to draw the bucket of water. He was drawing out of her that confession. And just like that, in chapter 5 here, we see this guy who, "Sir, I have no one to put me in." What was he saying? "I'm helpless. I can't do this. I can't do this myself. I'm helpless." And so Jesus commands him, "Get up, take up your pallet, and walk." There was no hocus pocus, no magic, no waving of the hand, no doing this weird stuff. He just said, "Get up, take up your pallet, and walk." And the Jews had a fit because he was walking with his pallet. Now, it always says, when you read something in the Gospels, and it says, "Now it was the Sabbath on that day," you know what's coming next. "Now it was the Sabbath on that day." It was like this ominous thing. So the Jews were saying to him, who was cured, "It is the Sabbath, and it's not lawful for you to take up your pallet." But he answered, the one who healed me, he said, "Take up your pallet and walk." You think about it, it was against the law, and it still is for us to work on the Sabbath. And obviously there are obvious exceptions that we don't need to, you know, spend a lot of time looking at those. But they were partly right when they said that he was working on the Sabbath and that it was unlawful for him to work on the Sabbath. But their interpretation, their understanding of work and what Jesus was doing was all messed up. So that when Jesus, who was the giver of the law in the first place, Jesus, and he told the guy, take up your pallet and walk, would Jesus ever tell us to do something that was unlawful? When he gives a command, just like he told the guy, think about it, what I said at the beginning, he just said to the guy, get up, take up your pallet and walk. When God speaks, things happen, don't they? Just like when he said to that guy, get up, take up your pallet and walk. He didn't have any, it wasn't like, you know, like in Hollywood would do it, they'd show him, you know, in this long, protracted, slow motion thing of him standing to his feet as the music began to, you know, reach this crescendo and this, and it was just, you know, this awesome melodramatic scene of it. He just stood up and he went around and he walked. And he took up his pallet, rolled it up and threw it on his shoulder and walked off. And it was like, wow. So the Jews see this and they had a fit, a royal fit. They were fit to be tied. And Jesus sees him in the temple and he says, behold, you have become well. Don't sin anymore so that nothing worse might befall you. And the man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who made him well. Sometimes I wonder why a lot of that stuff is written in the Bible. So why do we have all that stuff in the Bible that gives us these details? But if you follow the story, it says then, for this reason the Jews were persecuting Jesus because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. They wanted to kill him because he had done this. But listen, he answered them, my Father is working until now, and I myself am working. And that statement right there in verse 17 is pivotal to understand the entire chapter, I think, for this reason. When you follow along, Jesus sees the guy, asks him if he wants to be made well. He makes him well. The Jews are having a fit because he is walking around, working on the Sabbath, carrying that pallet, that burden of his. And all Jesus says was, my Father is working until now, and I myself am working. Think about what he just said. He just made a short statement. And it was just like, almost like they start foaming at the mouth. Listen to what happens. For this cause, therefore, the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but also was calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. See, to the Jew, they would never call God Father. They never referred to him as Father. In fact, if you look in the Old Testament, very seldom do you hear God referred to as Father. Because to the Jew, to call God Father was blasphemous. Because they understood the oneness of God. You know, in our theology, we talk about God being one in essence, but three in persons, and we try to pontificate and elaborate about the Trinity, which nobody understands. And if somebody tries to tell you or tries to act like they understand, run from that person because they're a flaming idiot, because nobody understands that. As much as I love to look at those things and even some of the philosophical thought and some of the real heavy-hitting theologians, it's like, wow, that stuff is really cool, but nobody understands. You can't understand. We can formulate it all we want and say he's one in essence and three in persons, and what does that mean? And you can contemplate it all the time if you want, but you're never going to figure it out. Because if you can figure God out, then what you're worshiping is an idol, because God can't be figured out. But anyways, he says, my Father is working until now, and I myself am working. Jesus knew the response that was going to evoke in the people. He knew exactly what he was saying. You know, I'm pretty much guilty of this when the Proverbs talks a lot of times about basically keeping your mouth shut, to put it bluntly. Because where there are many words, transgression is unavoidable, and I always think, I must like hearing the sound of my own voice as I talk a lot. But the Bible does say that where there are many words, transgression is unavoidable. In other words, if you're a blabbermouth, sooner or later you're going to stick your foot right in it and you're going to say too much. And Jesus just says, my Father's working until now, and I myself am working. What is he saying in there? Not only is he making himself equal with God, but he states it in such an emphatic way to the Jewish mind that they are fit to be tied. All in light of that healing that he did with that man when he told him, take up your bed and walk. He wasn't just an itinerant rabbi walking around. Jesus was saying that not only am I a teacher, what would you think, but one and the same, these things that I do. Let me read to you what John Calvin wrote, a sentence out of his commentary. He says, this is why he affirms so strongly that in his work he differs nothing from his Father. Jesus was saying, in the work that he just did in performing this miracle to heal the guy, he differs nothing from his Father. I myself am working also. My Father is working until now, and he was making himself equal with God, exactly, and the Jews were fit to be tied. If you look over in John chapter 10, the Jews, by this time, it was close to the end of Jesus' ministry, and they were, again, just, all right, this is enough. We're tired of listening to you speak and your stupid little metaphors and your cryptic language. Because you know how Jesus would always say things? He'd answer questions with a question. It almost sounded like he avoided it. You just shut up and tell us plainly, if you're the Christ, just tell us. And what did Jesus reply? He goes, I told you. I told you, and you wouldn't believe. He goes, the works that I do in my Father's name, these bear witness of me. Jesus is saying that actions speak louder than words. Think about how I talked to you earlier about how when God says something, things happen. Actions speak louder than words. Daddy, will you help me with my homework? Okay, son. Or daughter, let me help you with your homework. Daddy, what's 2 + 2? That's not helping your kid with homework if you tell them the answer is 4. You show them how they reach that conclusion, don't you? You pick up the textbook on a child's level. You have to not dumb yourself down, but bring yourself down to their level in language they understand and show them. Okay, you just simply take 2 objects over here and you ask, how many do I have in my hand? 2. 1, 2. Count them. 1, 2. And you do the same thing over in this hand. Then you take a basket and you put them together. What I'm doing is I'm adding 2 and this 2 plus 2 and you put them in a basket. Now count. You go, how many do you have? And then on a little childish level, you just 4! And they get all excited because they're the ones that reach the conclusion. You know, if you tell somebody the answer to the things, and that's what Jesus is doing. He's not just going to come down and give a bunch of questions and tests and give everybody the answer. He wants us to be able to add 2 and 2 and get 4. That's why he said he would say things like do the things that he did. And then he would say, my Father is working until now, and I myself am working. That's why I think that's very pivotal in understanding what the entire gospel, what this 5th chapter, because he goes on in the 5th chapter to say to them in this argument of theirs, truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself unless it is something he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, these things the Son also does in like manner. For the Father loves the Son, and he shows him all things that he himself is doing. And greater works than these will he show him that you may marvel. For just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son gives life to whom he wishes. Jesus is saying something absolutely radical that just floors the Jewish mind, just completely just blows them away. They just pins them up against the wall, just leaving them reeling, thinking, like just staring at him like, they're understanding what he's saying, but he's saying that just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son gives life to whom he wishes, that in Christ, and he goes on to state this even more emphatically, that in him is life, the very essence of life, the being that in the beginning was the Word and the Word was with God, that when God said, let there be light, when God breathed the breath of life into Adam's nostrils and he became a living being. That's what Jesus is saying here, that I myself am the one that breathed life into the universe. He says, for not even the Father judges anyone, but he has given all judgment to the Son, in order that all may honor the Son, even as they honor the Father. He who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. To the Jew, and when it talks about to the Jew in these chapters of John's Gospel, it's talking about the religious leaders, the Jews. And when they would hear them, they were often arguing with Jesus about what? What were they arguing with Jesus? What did it boil down to with their arguments that they always had with Jesus? Like in John chapter 10, who are you? They asked John the Baptist, who are you? We need to give an account to them who sent us. When they would ask Jesus, if you're the Christ, tell us plainly, who are you? And what is your authority for doing and saying these things? Who do you think you are? You're coming in here and turning our world upside down. You come in here and tell us these things. You know, in the Sermon on the Mount, it was one of the first Bible studies I think Pierre did is that he was forming the church here. Was one of the things was the Sermon on the Mount. When Jesus taught the Sermon on the Mount, he just completely turned everything they understood about the law upside down, saying about hate. If you hate your brother, you're guilty of murder. If you look at a woman to lust after her, you've already committed adultery in your heart. Every time I think of those things in the Gospel of Matthew and the Beatitudes, I think, when did Adam sin? When he ate the apple? He sinned long before he ate that apple, whatever it was. Could have been whatever piece of fruit it was, a forbidden fruit. He sinned the moment, if you ever see those little things on your cell phone when you send somebody a movie clip or a sound clip especially, it's got the little picture of the oscilloscope, the graphic representation of voice and how it goes up and down. And you see a little icon that's lit up that passes through as the voice. You see that, right? Where the heck was I going with that? But anyways, I just lost my train of thought. I'm sorry. When Adam sinned, if you try to find a point in time, thank you, Susie. When you can try to find that point in time when Adam sinned, it was at that moment that he decided, when he transgressed God's law in his heart, way before he reached out and took it and ate it. That's what, I'm trying to get at. So anyways, when Jesus is speaking here to the people, he's speaking about his authority, where he gets it from. And you read it. Read this on your own, the fifth chapter, and how many times he refers to being sent from the Father or him who sent me. It's several times in this passage. He says, truly, truly, I say to you, he who hears my word and believes him who sent me has eternal life and does not come to judgment but has passed out of death into life. And he's because the Jews are questioning his authority, and Jesus is he builds on what he's saying. He's claiming that Jesus has the authority to judge, and he refers back to Daniel chapter 7. Stand up. Daniel chapter 7. We have this heavenly figure coming, which is none other than God, and it says, I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were opened. What you see in there is a graphic picture of the great judgment throne of God. And when fire is coming out of the throne of God, what is that symbolic of? His judgment. Fire consumes those who are in unbelief. That's why fire is terrifying to us, because we get this imagery of God just pouring out his judgment from his throne instead of that river of water that we had to drink from. He's talking about the ungodly. They're consumed in his anger and wrath. And you see this picture in Daniel. And then he goes on to say, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, One like a son of man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and was given to him dominion, glory, and a kingdom that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. Daniel was showing this, and he says to him, one like a son of man was coming. When Jesus comes back in the clouds of great glory, it says, one like the son of man was coming. So that whenever you read in John's gospel about the son of man, that's Jesus' favorite self-designation, the son of man. He's referring to this heavenly being right here in Daniel that comes in power and great glory, the one who has authority to judge the nations, that God the Father has given him this authority. And Jesus is here claiming this authority. An hour is coming, and now is, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear shall live. For just as the Father has life in himself, so he gave to the Son also to have life in himself. What Jesus is saying is so radical that if you really understood in the Jewish mind, you would understand why they wanted to pick up stones to throw at him. For just as the Father has life in himself, he gave to the Son also to have life in himself. And he gave him, authority to execute judgment because he is the Son of Man. That's right out of the book of Daniel. He says, do not marvel at this, for an hour is coming which all who are in the tombs shall hear his voice and shall come forth. Those who do the good deeds to a resurrection of life, and those who commit evil deeds to a resurrection of judgment. Daniel 12, it says, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. Daniel is talking and referring to that, and that's what Jesus is referring to, that and many other places where it's taught in the Old Testament about the resurrection and the judgment to come. He says, I can do nothing. Back to John 5, I can do nothing on my own initiative. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just, because I do not seek my own will, but the will of him who sent me. If I alone bear witness of myself, my testimony is not true. There is another who bears witness of me, and I know that the testimony which he bears of me is true. You have sent to John, and he has borne witness to the truth. But the witness which I receive is not from man, but I say these things that you may be saved. He was the lamp that was burning and was shining, and you were willing to rejoice for a while in his light. But the witness, and this is key also, the witness which I have is greater than that of John. For the works which the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works that I do bear witness of me that the Father has sent me. You could not look at Jesus and see what he's doing and conclude anything other than that God sent him. Listen to what John chapter 10 says. After John chapter 9 is when Jesus healed the blind man. And that was a miracle that you would think of all the miracles that maybe the raising of Lazarus was one that just, that was just beyond belief, that the raising of Lazarus. But you would think that of all the miracles that the raising of Lazarus would have such an impact. But the healing of the blind man seemed to have a huge impact, because in John chapter 10, when they were arguing with Jesus and asking him if you were the Christ, I'm going to read in John chapter 10, verse 19, and listen to the impact of the healing of the blind man. There arose a division among the Jews because of these words, and many of them were saying, he is a demon and is insane. Why do you listen to him? Now they're saying, these are not the sayings of one demon possessed. A demon can't open the eyes of the blind, can he? You see the miracle that a lot of the people were like, wait a minute. A demon can't open the eyes of the blind. And then when Lazarus was dead, it says that the people, when Jesus came on the scene and he was talking to Mary and Martha and he was going to heal to raise Lazarus, a lot of the people were like, basically saying, the same thing. Could not this man who opened the eyes of him who was blind have kept this man from dying? And when Jesus raised him from the dead, they were just like, oh, you think that he healing a blind man to something, wait till you see this. And they were just left completely stunned. Because to the Jew, after 4 days, he began to stink. Well, because rot and decay had entered into his bones by then. On the fourth day, they thought that, you know, after 3 days, there was absolutely no hope of life again. But on the fourth day, it was beyond all hope to the Jew. And when they saw him on the fourth day raising, because it cracks me up when you read the story, it says that now Jesus loved Mary and Martha, so he stayed there for 4 more days. You'd think that if he loved them, he would hurry up, make haste, get on a donkey or something, a bus, and ride over to and save the day and heal Lazarus. So the people would go, oh, this must be the Messiah. But Jesus had something different in mind. And so he was always pushing people to make them, to stretch their faith. When they, you know, Mary and Martha, they said, Lord, if you'd only been here, you could have healed him. And he said, you know, do you believe that all things are possible? And he said to, and she said to him, yes, I believe that you are the Christ. And you know, that he'll raise again on the resurrection on the last day. And Jesus said, I am the resurrection. And he wasn't just saying, I effect the resurrection. I speak and things happen. He's saying, I myself am the resurrection. So that you put that together with John chapter 5. And he's just, read that on your own and look at that the whole idea of him, his authority, where does it come from? And him having the life in himself. At the end, Jesus says, and maybe I'll save this for next week because we are out of time. But he says, you search the scriptures because you think that in them you have eternal life, and it is these that bear witness of me. And you are unwilling to come to me that you may have life. I do not receive glory from men, but I know you that you do not have the love of God in yourselves. I have come in my Father's name, and you do not receive me. If another shall come in his own name, you will receive him. How can you believe when you receive glory from one another? And you do not seek the glory that is from the one and only God. Do not think that I accuse you before the Father. The one who accuses you is Moses, in whom you have set your hope. For if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote of me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? Every time I hear that, I'm just like stunned. Not only at their unbelief, but at what Jesus is saying is, don't think that I'm going to accuse you before the Father. The one who accuses you is Moses, in whom you have set your hope. Because they set their hope in Moses, and they had the law. They had the Torah, the law of God. And it was that was going to save them. They put their hope in all that. Jesus said, that's what's going to condemn you in the end, because it's those scriptures. You think that in them you have life. But it's these that bear witness of me, and you refuse to come to me, he says, that you might have life and hope. He goes, if you believed Moses, you'd believe me, for he wrote of me. And then he goes on to say, but if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? Where did Moses get what he wrote down? Where did he get it? Do you ever wonder that? Like sometimes when you read after the fact, a lot of these things were written, like the story of the woman in the well. None of the disciples were there. Nobody was there. There wasn't the stenographer like in a court typing everything that Jesus said or the woman said. And nobody was there but Jesus and the woman. We have this account as though somebody were watching and filming the whole thing, and we have this account. Do you ever wonder where that stuff comes from? I often do when I'm reading it, and it's like, well, where did they get this? Where did it come from? But Jesus is saying, if you believed Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote of me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my words? Think about the implications of that, and what when we pick this up, what do we call this? The Bible. It's nothing other than the book. Because that's what Bible means in the Greek words, is the book. So what, when you pick up your book, what does it mean? You do not believe his writings. How will you believe my words? So again, with that, just remember, when Jesus speaks, when God speaks, things happen, right? Think about that in light of chapter 5. And next week, we'll pick up again in that whole theme. I want to look at what Jesus thought about the Bible, what he thought about the words that he spoke, what he thought about like Moses' words. the implications of that last part of John chapter 5, what it has, what meaning it has, and what implications it has for us in this book that we have. So anyways, let's finish and pray. Lord, thank you so much for your word. They do, Lord, contain the words of life. And Father, I would never hope that I would think that I understand it all. And Lord, every time I think that I understand, how little I really know. And Lord, how much there is to plumb the depths of your word. And I pray, God, that as Christ came into this world to give life and light to all of us, Lord, that you would continue to enlighten and illuminate our minds and our hearts, that not only would we know these things in our minds, but Lord, that you would put these things in our hearts and plant these words in us, Lord, that you would create in us life and begin to make us to realize, Lord, how wonderful and how awesome your word really is in our life. Father, we thank you for your words. We thank you for this day. And we praise you, Lord, for your goodness and